So what I thought we'd do tonight is, you know, the first class, I wanted to talk about and have you read a few articles on sort of the theories of imperialism by Hoppe and the other people that were on the reading list. And then tonight, I thought we'd talk a little bit about war per se, some of the writings on war by some of my favorites, actually. The one essay by Rothbard, it's sort of a classic libertarian statement about war and the role of war. And then the famous War is a Racket essay by Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler, and also Randolph Bourne's War is the Health of the State. And I'm going to add some comments too from another essay I would recommend is that if you check out the Chapter of Human Action by Ludwig von Mises on the economics of war, which is online at Mises.org. I'm going to make reference to that as I go. And also, so these other writers, certainly Rothbard, but also Randolph Bourne and Smedley Butler make a few points that Mises also makes in his chapter in Human Action. And so there's some common ground there among these very, very different authors. And so what I thought I'd first start out doing is to make some comments about Smedley Butler's short little booklet on War as a Racket. And one of the first things he says is that only a small inside group knows what war is all about. And we're talking about imperialistic wars here, of course. And this is the same thing that Randolph Bourne says in his essay, War is the Health of the State. He says that it's always just in a representative democracy, essentially the so-called diplomats, which he considers to be a permanent war. He calls diplomacy just another form of war and planning for war, but it's usually just a small cabal of people, of conspirators who really know what the war is about. And of course, this brings to mind the American experience in Iraq, where Americans were first told that they were threatened by weapons of mass destruction. And then when those were not discovered anywhere, we were told that the purpose of the war is to bring democracy to Iraq. And so then it was nation building. And so there are all these different reasons for the war that are given. And then once they're sniffed out by the public, the state invents a different reason. And on it goes. Butler also distinguishes between war profiteering and the economic effects of war. He points out very correctly that, yeah, war is profitable. Some people make a lot of money. He refers to the war millionaire. And he has a big long list in his article of the copper industry, the steel industry, the shoe industry, and even has numbers on the amount of profits, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in profits made by various corporations, primarily during World War I, which was his big war that he participated in, one of many, I guess. And today this would be a little different. I think today you would add certainly the defense contractors and the military-industrial complex, but we also have a military-industrial media complex now. And when I reread this and ran across his words on war millionaires, I couldn't help but think of people like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all of the cheerleaders for war, none of whom has ever been anywhere near a war or even anywhere near a military uniform, for that matter, but they've become very, very well off in essentially being cheerleaders for endless war all around the globe in the past 20 years or so. And this the economic point, of course, that Mises would make here is that war is never good for the economy. That's what economists call the broken window fallacy, the idea that waging war is actually good for the economy. It's good for one part of the economy, the people who sell ammunition and goods and services of other sorts to armies and to the state. Yes, it's good for them. But because of the law of opportunity cost, all of those resources that would have been used to please consumer wants, to satisfy consumer wants, are diverted. They're diverted to warfare. And another important point is that a lot of the capital investment that would have been taking place in peacetime and put to use producing goods and services that would benefit the consumers, the ordinary person, are instead used to provide to make guns and tanks and airplanes and bombs, the purpose of which is to just kill people and destroy buildings. And so in any war, even the winners of a war have a much slower rate of economic growth for many years after the war because of the setback in capital investment, the diversion of capital investment from the consumer economy to the war economy. And so Smedley Butler touches upon that. He doesn't really explain it in that much detail. And he does a pretty good job of briefly discussing the costs of war. And of course, in terms of the blood and the death and so forth, he was an eyewitness. He was, as you know, I think I described him, or his bio describes him as the most highly decorated United States Marine in the history of the United States Marine Corps. We had more medals than anybody else. And of course, the costs of war include not only the bloodshed and the death, and he also discusses the mental problems about how just about every soldier who experiences real combat comes back home with some sort of mental problem for life. And of course, there's always the taxes that are paid by the public and the debt that is run up. And so that long after the war, many, many years after the war is over, the public pays higher taxes to finance the debt that was incurred to finance the war. There's often price inflation, the destruction of the capital stock, as I said. And he mentions a point that Mises mentioned, that it's the soldier who pays the biggest bill. And even the soldier who survives, if he survives, he makes a bigger sacrifice than anyone else, of course, by being in combat, in the war. And then when he comes home, he has to pay higher taxes for the rest of his life to pay off his share of the debt, the public debt that was incurred to finance the war. And so, as a career soldier himself, Smedley Butler understands this and is very articulate in enunciating that point. And it's sort of, it's almost laughable about how he talks about the metal business, M-E-D-A-L, about how easy it is for the government to impress young men by giving them medals, paying them next to nothing. In his day, soldiers were paid $30 a month, and even some of that was taken out of their pay by the government first if they had a family to send to the family. Then the government purchased for them out of the $30 a month funeral insurance and things like that, so that a lot of the soldiers actually got nothing on payday. So they were essentially slaves for the state. And conscripts in World War I and the other wars. But they were given lots of medals. And of course, this is true today. If you see any of the officers walking around anywhere on television or anywhere else, it seems as though all of them has at least 100 medals pinned to his chest of some kind, of some sort, and probably many more than that at home. An interesting point also that Burns makes about imperialistic wars is that the state has to come up with what he calls beautiful ideas for the wars. The real purpose of the war simply might be conquest and the confiscation of someone's property, the making of profits for some corporate supporters of politicians, things like that. But the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds who are sort of lured into the military or conscripted into the military have to be persuaded that there's something other than just purely making money. And so he talks about beautiful ideas, saving the Union in Abe Lincoln's day. Lincoln talked about the mystical Union that was supposedly the purpose of his war. And in that regard, I want to bring your attention. There's a book by one of the contemporary neoconservative author named Walter Burns, B-E-R-N-S. The name of the book is Making Patriots. And he's associated with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. And in Making Patriots, Burns writes about the, quote, problem, so-called problem, of the fact that too many American young people want to go to school, get a job, educate themselves, have a career, raise a family. Selfish, too selfish, says Walter Byrne. He says this, quote, we cannot be indifferent to the welfare of others, end quote, all around the world. So there's supposedly is a problem with the welfare of others around the world. It's a responsibility of America's young people to solve these problems at gunpoint if necessary. And so he bemoans the fact that too few Americans, even with the volunteer army, too few are volunteering for the volunteer army. And so he says we need to inspire patriotism. And what we need is, in his word, a national poet to mesmerize them, some sort of national poet. And this is very much in keeping with what Smedley Butler had to say about beautiful ideas. We need, the state comes up with all these so-called beautiful ideas to sort of dupe the youth of the country into participating in its wars. And Walter Byrne says that, well, fortunately, we have one of these. We have a national poet already. And he describes this man as a statesman, I'm quoting, a statesman, poet, and the martyred Christ of democracy's passion play. He refers, of course, to Abraham Lincoln. And so he makes the case that in his book, Making Patriots, that America's youth need to be inundated with selected snippets from Abe Lincoln's speeches, who he thinks will mesmerize them into joining the military and fighting aggressive and imperialistic wars all over the world in the name of reducing the suffering of others or increasing the welfare of others. And I've written about this on the web in an article on LouRockwell.com years ago entitled Making Cannon Fodder. Not making patriots, but making cannon fodder. Another point that Butler makes is he notes that all throughout history, the state has made the argument that God is on its side in killing, in waging war. He makes the point that in his wars, World Wars One and Two, the American government eventually made the argument that God was on its side to kill Germans, and then the German government made the same thing, that God was on its side supposedly to kill Americans. And as many of you know, I've written quite a lot on the American Civil War and Lincoln and these things. And Abe Lincoln really was the master of this, of making the arguments that God is on his side in waging a war that eventually killed as many as 850,000 Americans. That's the latest research on the death toll of the American Civil War. And Lincoln did this in his second inaugural address, where he said the war came, it just came, you know, as though he had nothing to do with it. And he made the argument that the war was God's punishment for the sin of slavery, is punishing all Americans in the northern states and the southern states. So he presumed to know what was in the mind of God, and he claimed that God was responsible for the whole bloody mess and the death of hundreds of thousands of people. And so he essentially blamed God for the whole mess in the second inaugural address. And politicians ever since then have tried to make some sort of argument like that, that God is on their side. Today, of course, in the United States, there are many millions of people, literally millions, who identify themselves as evangelical Christians, who are very big supporters of all the aggressive wars in the Middle East and elsewhere. And some of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with some of the people I'm talking about. And read almost any of Lawrence Vance's articles on LouRockwell.com, or read Lawrence Vance's book, Christianity and War, and it discusses a lot of these individuals and organizations and churches that sort of have this endless worship of the military. And so they've been pretty well captured by the state and supporting war. It sort of eerily reminds me of what my old friend Yuri Maltsev told me about life in the Soviet Union, where he spent the first several decades of his life, where he once told me that the KGB, the secret police in the Soviet Union, infiltrated whatever churches had survived. You know, the communists destroyed most of the churches and murdered most of the priests in the churches, but they allowed some to exempt, but eventually many or most of the priests, according to Yuri, were really KGB agents. And so they wanted to be able to keep an eye on people and spy on them. And in this business, I'm not saying that the Reverend Hagee and people like this who are cheerleaders from America's wars are CIA agents, but they do some sort of serve the same purpose of bringing the flock in line and getting their flock to support all of these wars. These are the people, by the way, who booed Congressman Ron Paul when he showed up at one of their big national conventions and stood up on the stage and reminded these all of these evangelical Christians that Jesus Christ is known as the Prince of Peace. And he was almost booed off the stage by saying that. And he had a similar experience in another group of Christians who, after there was this well-known American sniper, a soldier who was a sniper, wrote a book about how many hundreds of people he claims to have killed as a sniper. And he was murdered himself. He was murdered by a veteran, by an Iraq War veteran. And Ron Paul made a statement, quoting the Bible, "Live by the sword, die by the sword." And he was really denounced and viciously denounced by a lot of the evangelical Christian preachers and Hannity, Limbaugh, and all the talking heads, the pro-war talking heads, for quoting the Bible on this. And so that's an interesting point that Smedley Butler makes. Rothbard, I urge you to read the article that I put on the article list by Rothbard. It's sort of a vintage or classic Rothbard article on applying his libertarian non-aggression axiom to the whole issue of war and imperialism. And of course, he points out a number of salient points, such as under imperialistic wars or aggressive wars, the taxpayers are first plundered for the war, to pay for the war, and then there's some sort of permanent war bureaucracy that is set up, the expanded State Department, the occupation of Afghanistan in today's world, something like that. And the taxpayers are forced to foot the bill for that forever. We're still occupying Japan, in the United States military is. And so the taxpayers pay for all these things forever. And he makes the same point then that Randolph Bourne does and Smedley Butler does, is that war is rarely, if ever, in the interest of the ordinary person. And imperialistic wars are never, ever in the interest of the ordinary person. The ordinary person is just a taxpayer to be plundered for the war that supports the grandiosity of the state and all of its supporters who make war profits. And this is the article where Rothbard also makes the case against weapons of mass destruction, especially nuclear weapons, and because there's no way around it, that he makes the case that, yeah, if there is a defense of war, well, it's legitimate to collectively go after the bad guys who have created the problems, who have killed people and so forth. But with nuclear weapons, things like that, we kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians, and there's no justice in that, and there can never be any justice in that. And so, in an ideal just world, we wouldn't have these weapons. Now, in von Mises, in his chapter on the economics of war, he touches on this also, and there's a section where he makes the argument that, well, if you're going to war, most of the commentators of his day made the argument that, well, the government needs to nationalize various industries. We need to nationalize the shoe industry to make sure the soldiers have shoes. We need to nationalize the weapons industry and the transportation industry so we can have enough tanks and airplanes and things like that. Mises makes the opposite point that, well, no, if you want the efficient and cost-minimizing way of producing tanks and guns and shoes for the soldiers and so forth, you want to rely on private enterprise. You want to rely on the competitive enterprise system, not on government bureaucracy. But the conundrum, Mises points out, is that the private enterprise system is so good at this that, you know, we put it in charge of producing weapons, it'll produce weapons that could destroy the entire world. And indeed it did. And Mises was writing this right at the outset of the nuclear age. And so, and this certainly came true that, that, you know, we can produce weapons that can destroy the entire world, if the politicians, get carried away with them. Randolph Bourne also touches upon one of the real essential points about war that Mises makes, and Bourne does this later on in his essay, where the main point that Mises makes on the very first page of his essay is that the division of labor, the international division of labor in society, is the very opposite of war. The division of labor is one big network or latticework of individuals who cooperate with each other in a voluntary way to produce goods and services for their fellow man, and in return they get paid. And so we all specialize in something, and we make money doing that something, and then we use the money to buy things for our daily lives from people who specialize in other things. And that is really just the opposite of war. War is all about killing people and isolating yourself from other people and destroying things. And so both Mises and Bourne make that point. And Mises also makes another point that we talked about last week, when I talked about imperialism, is that there's a misconception by, especially, this is an idea that the Marxists have promoted for many years, that the 20th century wars were caused by capitalism. But no, Mises points out that no, it's really the quest for governmental omnipotence that created all these wars in the 20th century. It wasn't capitalism. Capitalism is free voluntary trade among consenting adults. It's not stealing at the barrel of a gun. It's not killing. It's just the opposite of that. In fact, the very essence of war is necessitated by the existence of states. Mises makes this argument, and Randolph Bourne makes this argument, that it's the very existence of the state as being what it is that creates war and conflict. And Bourne, you know, I'd like to go over a number of points that Randolph Bourne makes in his essay, and the first one is that the state has almost nothing to appeal to the ordinary person, the state in itself. You know, when George Washington was the first American president, he was basically the administrator of a very tiny little bureaucracy, most people are put off by government, the Department of Motor Vehicles, the garbage collectors, and so forth. And it's really, you know, a big bunch of nothing. However, it's really the shock of war, as Randolph Bourne says, that really causes the state to come into its being. The shock of war. Then the state becomes grandiose. It becomes something. But without war, it's really a big nothing, a menace to most people. You know, for example, even at the outset of the American Civil War, the average American, contact the average American had with his central government was through the post office, and the average American working family paid about $45 a year in taxes, and so it was pretty much inconsequential. But that, in my view, was the watershed event, the American Civil War. You know, we had that, and we had the Indian Wars. As soon as the Civil War ended, there was a 25-year wars of genocide against the Plains Indians, the Spanish-American War, and the conquest of Puerto Rico and the Philippines, World War I, and then the 20th century of war. And we're going to those are all the things we're going to talk about in the next 2 weeks in this course. And an important point that Bourne makes is the same one that Smedley Butler made. He says this: all foreign policy, the diplomatic negotiations which produce or forestall war, are the private property of the executive part of the government and are equally exposed to no check whatever from popular bodies or the people voting as a mass themselves. So just as Smedley Butler said, it's just a few people who get us into these wars, And the people themselves certainly have nothing whatsoever to do with it, nor do their representatives for the most part. Just think of what's been going on in the U.S. today with Obama being forced by public opinion for the first time in a long time to consider congressional approval before he bombed Syria, which he still may do. But he was very clear that if he decides he wants to bomb Syria, he's been very clear that he doesn't really need congressional approval. And we even have several senators, including Lindsey Graham, who is actually working up some sort of congressional authorization, so-called, from the Senate that would allow Obama to just go ahead and bomb away without asking the Congress. And so this point is very well taken, that wars are typically done by a few people in the executive branch of government, and no one else is really involved. And then once a war is started, though, the citizen is transformed from really not caring much about government to identifying with himself. The citizen identifies himself with the government. Here's what Bourne says. The citizen throws off his contempt and indifference. And so originally we have a normal attitude by normal people is to have contempt for their government and or indifference to the government. But this all changes with war, and the state once again walks in august presence, Randolph Bourne says. And so another thing that seems to happen, and this all rings true, I think. This essay was written in the early 20th century, but the patriot, so-called, I think he's mocking the word, mockingly using the word patriot, loses all sense of distinction between the state, the nation, and the government, seems to equate the nation with the government. And Bourne does a nice job here of talking about, you know, the nation is what, it's the people, the civil society, all of our businesses, all of our charities, education, the entrepreneurship that goes on, and the religions that exist within a country. This is the nation, this is the country, but that tends to be conflated with the state. Everything becomes the all-one. And here's what he says, the country is an inescapable group into which we are born and which makes us a particular kind of a citizen of the world seems to be a fundamental fact of our consciousness. So that's one thing, the country, but we tend to conflate that with the state or with government. And so the idea of country or nation is really a peaceful concept. It's people going about their lives, educating themselves, working, starting up businesses, working their businesses, engaging in charitable acts, practicing their religion or not, and so forth. But the state is very different. The state is essentially, in Bourne's words, a concept of power, of competition. It signifies a group in its aggressive aspects. That's the state. So the history of America as a country is very different than the history of the state. It's very, very different. Another thing that happens once a war starts is that minority opinion has to be outlawed or has to be diminished at the very least. And we have a long history of that in the United States. Beginning with the Sedition Act, under President John Adams. President John Adams signed into law the Sedition Act, which essentially made it illegal to criticize him and his administration. And so and people were imprisoned for this, including a member of Congress from Vermont named Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, as I can spell that. And he was imprisoned for criticizing President John Adams. And referring him, John Adams was quite the fat guy, and so Congressman Lyons referred to him as his rotundity in a speech, and for that he was arrested and imprisoned. And newspaper editors were put in jail also for criticizing the government. And then the next big assault on the critics of government and of war was during the Lincoln administration in the United States, where the suspension of habeas corpus took place, and there was the mass arrest of tens of thousands of northern state civilians for merely criticizing the government and its war policies. hundreds of newspapers were shut down, and the telegraphs were censored. And so that really set the template for cracking down on minority opinion in wartime. And this was carried forward to World War I, which is what Randolph Bourne is mostly writing about, where people were also imprisoned. There were people in prison for reading the Bill of Rights in public, for example. And so that was made illegal under the Espionage Act. Anything that could be construed as discouraging enlistments in the army or encouraging conscripts to not participate in conscription could end up in jail during World War I. And so that's why Bourne writes about the minorities or people who object to war are subject to what he calls ferocious penalties. And he says that another thing that happens is anything pertaining to the enemy becomes taboo. And this brought to mind the fact that during the Iraq War, some of you who are in the class might remember that there was even a member of Congress who, because the French did not initially participate in the Iraq War, there was a member of Congress who issued a resolution saying we should not use the phrase French fries anymore. We should call them freedom fries. So anything pertaining to the enemy becomes taboo. In Randolph Bourne's day, anything pertaining to Germans became poisonous. German music, German anything, German language, German Americans became very suspect, if not taboo, because of government war propaganda. And so the state always enforces some sort of penalties and some sort of bureaucracy to intimidate, at the very least, intimidate people from criticizing its war policies. In the recent years, some of the cheerleaders for war, the so-called neoconservatives in all their magazines like National Review, and Weekly Standard, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, National Review magazine put on its cover at the beginning of the Iraq War. The story was called Unpatriotic Conservatives, and they were referring in particular to Lou Rockwell and the Mises Institute and people like myself who were opposed to our invasion and conquest of Iraq, which never posed any threat to us and never did any harm to us. And so you have these sort of appendages of the state, supporters of the state who are not formally a part of it, who help out in trying anyway to intimidate people. And Randolph Bourne writes about this, about how all citizens become sort of the enforcers of the official view of the state. And so a very dangerous thing that happened is the distinction between the society and the individual is almost blotted out. So we adopt this collectivist idea. Or ideal, in other words. Another thing that happens with war that allows the government to get away with its imperialistic wars is people tend to become obedient. They're intimidated, for one thing, and they tend to be frightened. That's why the state always has to have a new boogeyman, a new Hitler. It always has to be on the horizon. It was Saddam Hussein a few years ago. Now it's Assad and Syria. There's always has to be another Hitler on the horizon out there that we're supposed to be frightened of in some sort of calamity that's about to befall us unless we grant the state more power and give up more of our personal liberties. And unfortunately, a lot of people, Randolph Bourne says, are sort of have this hunger to be treated like children and have a parent take care of them, no matter how old they are. And here's what he says: the people at war have become, in the most literal sense, obedient, respectful, trustful children again, full of that naive faith in the all wisdom and all power of the adult, meaning the state, who takes care of them, imposes his mild but necessary rule upon them, and in whom they lose their responsibility and anxieties. And so you certainly do see this, I think, in the I'm going to make a few more points here from Randolph Bourne. he actually talks about, you know, he uses the word terrorism to describe what happens to pacifists, socialists, enemy aliens, and also a milder form of persecution against all persons or movements. So, and the idea is to create a situation of where if you're not really in line with the state's objective, you're some sort of social enemy, social pariah, and people are very very easily intimidated into doing that, being going along with the state's wars for fear of being called unpatriotic. And so, an important point that Bourne and Mises make, and also Smedley Butler, is that there's nothing natural about war, and that, you know, human beings don't have this natural pugnacity, as he says, to band together collectively and invade Canada or another country. That's the state that does that sort of thing. You know, there are criminals. There's evil in the world. There are many individuals who behave very badly. And in any society, you're going to have a lot of individuals who behave very badly, but that's not really war. That's crime, and so, but war is organized by the state. So even if we didn't have a state, yes, there would be a lot of terrible things that would happen, because there are always some percentage of any population that is just horrible, antisocial, criminal, and so forth. But whatever damage they could do is really nothing compared to what the states have done in the past several hundred years, in terms of murdering hundreds of millions of people in an organized basis. And so the very existence of states, competing for land, competing for resources, competing for power and prestige, is the main cause of war, according to Bourne. And I think he's right on the money there. He says this: the very existence of the state in a system of states means that the nation lies always under the risk of war and invasion, and the calling away of energy into military pursuits means the crippling of the productive and life-enhancing processes of the national life. That's a great statement of what Ludwig von Mises says in his chapter on the economics of war, and how war is just the very opposite of capitalism. It's a diversion of resources from, you know, life-enhancing processes of national life to killing, destruction, explosions, conquest, occupation, everything that aggressive or imperialistic war is all about. And there are a few more points I wanted to comment on that Randolph Bourne makes. Okay, one very salient point he makes is that, and Rothbard makes this point also, is that some of the worst penalties that the government has in terms of criminal penalties, jail sentences, fines, are whenever you commit a crime against the state. You know, they're always much harsher than anything else. Here's what Warren says: the inextricable union of militarism and the state is beautifully shown by those laws which emphasize interference with the army and navy as the most culpable of seditious crimes. Those are the most culpable, the worst imaginable. And the very last few sentences of Randolph Bourne's essay are, I think, a great summary of his views, and it's worth repeating, I think, worth reading. He says this: the state has thus becomes an instrument by which the power of the whole herd is wielded for the benefit of a class, a relatively small group. The rulers soon learn to capitalize the reverence which the state produces in a majority and turn into a general resistance toward the lessening of their privileges. The sanctity of the state becomes identified with the sanctity of the ruling class. We would call it the military-industrial congressional complex, I guess. And the latter are permitted to remain in power under the impression that in obeying and serving them, we are obeying and serving society, the nation, and the great collectivity of all of us. And so we're duped, in other words, into thinking that by supporting the state and its aggressive wars, that's how we serve society. But of course, from an economic perspective, you serve society best by going to work, by investing in a business, by running a business, by participating in a team that produces goods and services for your fellow man for a price, participating in capitalism. That's also a public service, and it's peaceful. And so you really are serving the state. You're really serving the politician and the political class when you support aggressive or imperialistic war. Randolph Bourne says, and I think he's right on in that regard. And so, and those are the main points I want to make for tonight. I wanted to spend the first two classes, as far as my role here, is talking about some of the sort of theoretical points that are in the literature and what I would call Austrian social theory on war and imperialism. And then the rest of the next 2 weeks, we're going to talk about mostly history in terms of actual imperialism and all of the mostly America's wars. And the final class will be the anti-imperialistic tradition in America. And so I'll wrap it up there as far as my commentary, and we'll do what we usually do. I'll be glad to try to answer whatever questions anybody has here. And so I'll sit here while you scratch your head. And I think Cam has been doing his usual great job with all the links and things that and references to the things I've been saying. So feel free. I'll see if there's anything on the Q&A. Any questions? We're in a quiet group tonight. Let's see. Now Joshua's talking about all the medals he got. He personally got a fruit salad of medals. Yeah, you know, my old professor, graduate school professor, Gordon Tullock, when I reread this, a comment he made once popped into my head that the government gets away with not paying the military soldiers very much and giving them medals instead, because young men have this this desire to have medals. And of course, they're better paid now with the volunteer army, but still. Gordon Tullock looked at medals as a substitute for actual pay for what they were doing. Oh, sure, yeah, reenlist. That's an incentive to reenlist. Okay. Okay, any questions? I'll sit here for a few more minutes, I guess. You don't have to ask questions. It's not mandatory. Joshua was asking about how the International Division of Labor is disrupted by war. Well, you know, one way of looking at it is in the late 19th century in America, it was called, historians call it the Second American Industrial Revolution. And so there was, and this was going on in much of Europe also and other parts of the world, the development of industry, the development of manufacturing, especially after electricity became commercialized. And so, you know, the steel industry, the railroad industry, the oil industry all expanded greatly. And so, globalization was taking place at a much more rapid pace than it ever had before. because people were producing goods and services, and markets were expanding. The shipping industry was becoming more and more sophisticated with steamships as opposed to sailing ships. And so the whole network of the International Division of Labor was causing people to cooperate or collaborate with one another, benefit from doing business with one another. And people from all over the world could take advantage of products that were made thousands of miles away, were made and were presented to them very cheaply. And so that all stopped with World War I. World War I stopped all of this, all of the international division of labor between the United States and Europe and much of Europe and parts of the rest of the world too, for several years. And you could even make the argument, I think, that the international division of labor that was proceeding very nicely in the late 19th and the very first years of the early 20th century were put on hold from World War I, and then we had a relatively short amount of time before World War II started, which is another major disruption in globalization, if you will. And then the Cold War and the advent of communism took all the communist countries, exited from the International Division of Labor. And it really wasn't until the final collapse of communism in the late 80s and early 90s that the world returned to some sort of semblance of a true international division of labor, because all of these other countries that had been prohibited by the communists from participating in the international division of labor finally could attempt to do so by the mid-90s. And so we basically went from roughly 1917, 1918, to 1992 with the International Division of Labor only a small fraction of its potential because of war, because of World War I, World War II, the Cold War, communist imperialism, and the rest of it. And so that's the point that von Mises was making, I think. Okay, Chris is asking about a book that I mentioned in the last class about dividing the country up into different countries. Let's see, I still have it laying around here. Well, the book is Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century, and the editor is Donald Livingston. And I did have it sitting around on my desk, but I guess not. I put it back on the bookshelf. But that's it. It's Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. It's a book of essays. One of my essays is in there. Yuri Maltsev is in there. I think Cam ran down the Amazon link here. And it basically makes, in different ways, makes the case for a smaller government as being the only really meaningful way of having a representative democracy is in a small government. And of course, a country of 330 million people is totally unworkable, and it really makes no sense to even talk about representative government in a system like that. And so so that's the book. That's the book, and I not just because I have an essay in it, but I highly recommend it. Don Livingston is a great scholar, and these are all very good essays about rethinking the American Union in the 21st century. Yeah, Joshua was asking about Russian and German artists. Oh, sure, is it realistic to say they fell out of style because of war? Oh, sure, the whole Cold War led to the demonization of Russian literature, certainly Russian artists. But although a lot of the Russian artists were sort of perverted by communism, a lot of the so-called art because of what these people had been turned into by communism. A lot of them had very bleak perspectives on life. My old friend Yuri, who I referred to several times, told me he knew quite a few people who became severe alcoholics and died at a young age because they saw no future under communism. They didn't think anything could ever be better So they became very short-sighted and decided to drink themselves to death because they enjoyed drinking. It was the one thing they enjoyed, and they did it so much that they killed themselves, you know, by age 40 or something like that. And I think the same sort of thing happened to a lot of artists under communism who their art reflected this this mindset. Yeah, certainly not all of them, but some. Let's see, John is asking about his belief that the U.S. is on the verge of economic collapse for the monetary policies. Well, we've adopted pretty much, you know, one of my old articles on the web from Lou Rockwell, I invented a word called spatialism, and I made the case that the economic system is a combination now of socialism and fascism. You know, large parts of the economy are nationalized, healthcare being the latest on the road to full nationalization. The automobile industry is a part of it, is essentially nationalized. The banking industry has been mostly nationalized. And then fascism means private property and private enterprise is permitted, but it's so heavily regimented and controlled by the government, it might as well be owned by the government. And so that's the economy. And that's a recipe for disaster, economic disaster and stagnation, to be sure. And we also have this giant police state with the NSA spying on everybody and the giant warfare state. And so, yes, that's and government in the United States is virtually unlimited now. I just was in the next thing I'm going to blog on LouRockwell.com, there's an article about a man in Howard County, Maryland, who's a parent, and they had a town meeting on the government's Common Core. They want to impose federal standards on all the schools in the country, public schools. He stands up to ask a question, and he's bullied by a cop, shoved around by a cop, pushed out of the room, and arrested for simply asking a question about the critical question about the so-called Common Core. That's the kind of country America has become. And so, I can't see anything that John has written here that I think is incorrect. The abandonment of the Constitution, all three branches of government, American school children used to be taught something about the Constitution. I don't think they're taught anything anymore, hardly. But they used to be taught that the separation of powers was a good thing, that we had an executive branch, a judicial branch, and a legislative branch, and that was set up to limit governmental power by distributing power into different branches. But the way it's turned out is that the three branches conspire together against us, against the people. The Supreme Court rubber stamps just about everything the legislature does, and so we're all pretty much at the mercy of an unlimited government. That's why for quite a long time, 15 years or more, I've been writing about secession and nullification as the only real alternatives to escape this. The Soviet Union imploded by a dozen or so peaceful acts of secession. And so I think that's what has to happen to the United States. Thomas Jefferson thought that it would even happen, not too far from his day. And he said in a letter that if America separated into several different confederacies, Thomas Jefferson said, then we would wish them all well because they would all be our children. Those are his words. And so I think this is what has to happen. Let's see, Jose is asking about the present economic decline of the U.S., China will eventually lead to armed conflict. Not with China. The American warfare state is very careful not to pick wars with anyone who can shoot back on an equal footing. And so if you look at all the wars we've had since World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Libya, Afghanistan, countries like this, Syria, you know, so there, I don't think there's any threat of going to war with China. It's too big, and has too big an army. Of course, an alternative is to engage in a peaceful coexistence with China and to trade more with them, because the Chinese government is still very, very communistic and very fascistic, as ours is. And so, that's the real threat is, to both countries, in my view. Yeah, Bob, I guess Bob has read Kirkpatrick's sales essay in the book, Rethinking the American Union, where yeah, he does point out that the American prison population is 25% of the entire world prison population. That's fueled primarily by the war on drugs, which benefits the state immensely, all the thousands and thousands of people who earn a good living enforcing the war on drugs. They're the beneficiaries. It's not just fighting wars that these principles apply to that Randolph Bourne talks about. I teach another class at the university, at Loyola University, on the political economy of war, and I usually reserve the last several classes on other wars, like the war on drugs, war on poverty, the war on fat the government has declared, and so it's not only military wars. Let's see, Joe was talking about, there's a nice link there, NGOs becoming a new power structure. Well, sure. Yeah, this is a lot of these so-called NGOs, non-governmental organizations, are set up by governments, especially the U.S. government, and funded by them. Like the National Endowment for Democracy is something that's funded by the U.S. government. And it is essentially an arm of the CIA. It goes around, trying to create rebellions and insurrections in places of the world where the U.S. government would like to disrupt and create chaos. And so a lot of these are indeed tools of imperialism. Thanks for the link. The glorification of the military and the glorification of the police were hallmarks of fascism in Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 30s. It's almost a textbook definition. And that's what we're seeing in the United States today with everything. I was on an airplane last week, Delta Airlines, where the flight attendants went on, they broadcast on the loudspeaker. They said, we have two members of the military on the airplane. Let's all give them an applause, even though they're not in uniform. We know that they're on here. And the whole plane erupts in applause because two guys in the military happened to be on the airplane. And to me, it was just totally creepy, this worshiping of everything military, everything police. That's one of the bad things, bad legacies of 9/11. Was that, the so-called first responders, the police and the firemen, and other highly paid government bureaucrats were turned into heroes, even if they'd never done anything heroic. And so, I don't think that's a good thing for society. If I'm at a baseball game and they do the Pledge of Allegiance, I never pledge allegiance to the state. Those of you who are religious, you might want to reconsider doing this yourself. If you're a Christian, do you really want to pledge your allegiance to Barack Obama and John Bonner, rather than God? Think about it that way. And so this is just another tool of intimidation. The Pledge of Allegiance, by the way, if you look it up on the web, was authored by a late 19th century socialist minister from New England, Francis Bellamy, who was defrocked for and kicked out of his pulpit for preaching that Jesus Christ was a socialist. And he said that he wrote the Pledge of Allegiance because he wanted to inculcate in the minds of children, mostly, obedience to the centralized state that was created during the American Civil War. And I've written an article or two on it on lewrockwell.com, and quite a few other people have also. I think my article that I wrote years ago was called Pledging Allegiance to the Omnipotent Lincolnian State. And I quoted Bellamy himself in there. I think Cam immediately got the link there. And these are all tools of imperialism. That's a good tip from Rod about the Elmer Barnes and his article, Revisionism, the Key to Peace. Of course, Murray Rothbard was an outstanding revisionist historian, so-called. And, you know, and by the way, I think just about all historians are revisionist historians. I just got an email alert that a new book has come out on Woodrow Wilson. Now, why would someone write yet another book on Woodrow Wilson if they didn't have something that they thought was a little different to say about Wilson? So, you know, all history books are revisions of previous history because, you know, we take the same historical facts, and an economist like myself will look at a lot of these historical facts in a very different light, especially someone who's familiar with libertarianism, than other people will. And so, the term revisionist has been used to demonize people because, you know, there are like Holocaust deniers who are called revisionist historians. And so a lot of people play the game. If they want to discredit the views of a Rothbard, for example, they'll try to insinuate that, well, he's a revisionist, kind of like the Holocaust deniers are also revisionists. But of course, all history is revisionist. It's a revision of an interpretation of history from a different perspective, the perspective of that particular author. Cam bought the book for $6, under $6. Good. Here's the, Bob, right, the Bellamy Salute, Pledge of Allegiance. Yeah, until the 1930s, American school children did a salute like this. I don't know if you can see me there. Like this, rather. And that got to be a little too close to the Nazi salute like this, or the Mussolini salute. And so they did away with it. But you can, if you go on the web and look for pictures of children in the Pledge of Allegiance, I think you'll probably find pictures. Maybe I might try to find it real quick here. Francis Bellamy, he was the cousin of Edward Bellamy. And Edward Bellamy wrote the book Looking Backward, and it was a fantasy about, it was published in 1888, about a man who falls asleep in 1887 and awakens in the year 2000 where there's a socialist paradise on earth. And so Francis Bellamy, the author of the Pledge of Allegiance, said that his goal with the pledge and his life goal was to try to make this become a reality, socialist utopia. In America, and so that's what he wanted to do. So yeah, there's a guy on the web, I can't recall his name now, who put together a whole bunch of pictures of school children with their sort of Nazi-like salute in the 1930s, but it became a little too close to what the Nazis and the fascists in Italy were doing at the time, so they no longer did it in the American public schools. Any more questions here? Yeah, the Bellamy Salute is what it's called. You can probably look that up, Bellamy Salute, and you'll find pictures of it on the web. Okay, looks like everybody's running out of gas here. More commentary. Well, then we'll call it a night then. Thanks a lot for participating again. I hope you learned a little something. That's our goal, of course. And I did promise to make up a little quiz, which I will do for anyone who wants a grade for the class. And so in the next couple of days, Danny Sanchez will administer it online. If anyone wants to take a quiz based on the first two classes and the associated readings, it'll be a true and false quiz. And I'll do the same thing after the fifth class. And have a good evening or morning, depending on what part of the world you are. Let's see, I'll be rooting for the Raiders because they beat the Ravens, and I'm a Ravens fan. So, yeah, the Raiders are playing football tonight.